All right. Let's chat about Unto the Sons and your work. I remember reading flipping years ago. It must have been in the middle 80s, 86, 88, something like that, which it said that was your next project and that the book was going to be published by Doubleday. Remember that?
I do.
What happened? What happened to Doubleday? Where did Doubleday go?
A lot of things change. I thought I'd get this book done in 3 years, and it's taken 10. During that long, long period, my wife, who's been an editor for the better part of 30 years, was hired by Doubleday after I had this book contract of this book, you know, hold. My wife joined the company, and we had a problem. We knew it. I thought it was a problem of conflict of interest. But I was midway between a book at that time. You mentioned 1986, and I had started this book in 1981. And I was midway through, and I did not want to interrupt the writing of the book to hire an agent and see where I could go. My wife, on the other hand, was so thrilled at going to Doubleday. She was hired by a man named Alberto Vitali, who subsequently would quit and go to Random House. So you see how this publishing world that you know so much about changes. I don't have to tell you. It's just hard to keep in touch with the players because they change uniforms so often. And but anyway, 86 was a year in which I did virtually nothing about moving. I waited until I finished the book, which I did in 1990. At that time, I approached the people in charge of Doubleday, and they agreed that it wouldn't work out. Because if you have a wife in a book publishing company that's going to publish your own book, she sits in on all the meetings prior to publication, all the meetings that will decide how that book is going to be marketed. It is a matter of how many books are you going to print. What's the first printing? It'll be 10,000, 20,000, 100,000, what will it be? Secondly, how are we going to advertise it? Thirdly, it might have to do with the editing itself. Is this book too long, too short? Let's change this around. Let's do that. The jacket. Is this a tractor jacket? Maybe the binding, we should do it more cheaply, more expensively. All these questions, Don, you know. I don't think many people care that are listening in right now, except book publishing people, the real trade people in the firm or in the whole industry producing books. But if you have a wife sitting in on these meetings and other editors might be working on the book with me, not her, of course, but someone else, and then she may have ideas of how the book should be published, and they have other ideas, and it's no good for anybody. So it was generally agreed with me and an agent and Doubleday and its own fact-finding group that that's probably a good idea that I look for another publisher, and I did.
Were you working with an advance? What were some of the ramifications?
Oh, of course, I had an advance.
So
paid it back. We paid it back with interest. The interest was very high because, well, it's my own fault. It takes so long to write a book. I took 10 years, as I said before. 10 years was necessary, as I saw it, to do this book. But after I finished the book, I paid back the money and the interest included, and I signed up with Knopf, which is the publisher of this book. And I'm very pleased with the publishing. They produced a beautiful book.
Well, that's certainly an advantage with Knopf. They probably publish the most beautiful trade books in the industry.
I can't argue with that because my book is an exquisite product.
Yeah, it's beautifully done and beautifully packaged, and it is. I'm a kind of guy who I like the tactile feel of books. You know, I like books as
many people
objects.
I do too. When you buy a hardcover book, you know, you're paying $25 at least. Sometimes you're paying a little more, sometimes a little less, but still, a hardcover investment is not inconsiderable, especially now. And you want to have something that not only reads well and has some usefulness in your life, but also has a pleasant or striking appearance going for it.
And it must give you an enormous feeling of pride, too, to be able to pick up this book and
say,
you know, this is something I've done. And look, it's all in cloth.
Absolutely. Well, you notice that, and I think... Yes, it's fully lined with cloth. It's a beautiful book. I mean, I don't know what the prizes are for book binding or book display or jacket. I mean, there must be prizes annually that art directors give or are given, I should say. And if this book should certainly be to use the words of Ilya Kazan, a contender. This has to be a contender.
Well, you did a lot of research in this book. You actually went to Italy to look at the homeland of your ancestors, right? Tell me about that.
Well, the idea for the book didn't come from any editor. It came from within myself. I was 50 years old in 1981, and I had been known as a writer of nonfiction. I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people for various kinds of stories, written books on various subjects, always about other people, other things, which are very typical, I guess, of people who spent their whole life in research, researching for periodicals, be they newspapers, magazines, or book publishers, about other people's lives. I always try to understand the world through the people I was interviewing. There were times, Don, in this long experience, I may be going on too long, but there were times when I've encountered Italian-Americans. Most of them are pretty famous Italian-Americans. The most famous of my interviews with Italian-Americans were Joe DiMaggio and Frank Sinatra. I'd say the most infamous, and maybe just as well-known, were some of the mafia people that I wrote about in a book called Honor Thy Father. When I would be interviewing, whether it's a mafia person like Bill Bonanno, who's in Honor Thy Father, or whether it's Joe DiMaggio as an American folk hero of the world of sports, or someone like Frank Sinatra, who is an international figure and has been for several decades as a performing artist, I would be privately identifying with them as an Italian-American, and during the course of the interviewing, I would be prone to ask them about their own background. And I would find, not that I would write this, I'm talking about my private ingestion of this information. I would be wondering how they lived as children, how they lived as adolescents in an Italo-American home, how they, if they were old enough, and most of these people are, what was it like for them during World War II when Italy was part of the Nazi regime, in that it was the enemy of the United States, of England, Canada, other allies. What was it like for these other people, the Sinatras, etc., the Mario Cuomos, the Geraldine Ferraros, the Senator Alphonse D'Amatos? They're people that are generally around my age group, a little younger, a little older, but we all have a childhood recollection or an adolescent recollection of World War II. And I wonder about this, because I knew what a severely unsettling experience those war years were for me when I was only 12 and 11 years of age, raised on the southern shore of New Jersey in a home headed by an Italian-born tailor, my father, and my mother. Her parents came from the same village in Italy as my father did, and all my relatives on both sides, not all but nearly all, on both sides were still in Italy at that time in the 1940s, and the male members of these families were all in the fascist army, a link with the Nazi troops, protecting and later on fighting against, protecting the land of Italy and later fighting against the invaders of Italy, who were General Eisenhower's troops sent from North Africa. Eisenhower had under him such generals as General Patton, General Mark Clark, and the English, distinguished English General Bernard Montgomery. And these armies, under the overall heading of leadership of General Eisenhower, who was stationed in North Africa, were there to obliterate Italy. This was enemy territory. Well, on that enemy territory were all the Tullis family members that I was aware of, except for my mother and father, who, as I said, were part of an immigration group, a very small one for my own family. And while my name was what it is, other people in that same area of southern Italy, who were the forebears of Mario Cuomo and Joe DiMaggio, and you name it. I mean, these people you've had on your show, or you know about from watching them being interviewed, or just know about them because they're well known, southern Italians all went through what I went through, except if they're so young, you know, if they're rock stars who are now 24 years of age, of course they wouldn't qualify for anything I'm saying. But the idea of what was it like to be an Italian-American when your whole fatherland, if you think of it in that way, was part of the Axis Empire and part of the enemy. Well, for me, as a schoolboy, I really hated myself. I grew up with an idea of wanting to lose myself, lose whatever identity I had that was foreign-born. To this day, I cannot speak a word of Italian, though I've been tutored. I've tried. Psychologically, I'm blocked on this thing. Now, I went through a very successful career. If I don't sound sufficiently modest, please forgive me. I succeeded as a journalist in the New York Times. I wrote books sufficiently popular to warrant attention such as you're graciously giving me this morning. I, however, have never dealt with this man that I am. This man that I am is an interviewer. I have never turned it around and interviewed myself. Obviously, that's not so easily done on a news show. It also requires a lot of self-acceptance, which I confess to you that I didn't have for most of my life. 1981, I turned 50. It was a birthday I could have done without. 50 to me marked a period when I was no longer able to identify with vigor or youth, even though I like to think, and still do, that there's some vigor left in me. At 50 years of age, I looked at my parents. Fortunately, my parents were alive then as now. Then they were pushing 80, now they're pushing 90. I thought, I'm a man who spent all my working life looking to sources to get information. What information is there around about me, about where I come from, who I am? What is my stock in a sense that I can live with it? My sources were, primary sources I mean, were my two parents. I had never interviewed them. Few people do. Even in our business, the news business, the interview business, we interview everybody else but those most close to us. I mean, that's our business. Our business doesn't, it teaches objectivity. I came out of the New York Times tradition. The last thing you were told that you ever could do is put a reporter in a story. You're out of it. You're not part of the story. And that's my training from my editors in the New York Times. So I certainly had never had myself in a story that I wrote. At the age of 50, this important time in my life, I guess I sensed my own perishability. Although my parents were vigorous, as I said, at that age, 25 and more years older than myself, I started interviewing them. Who are we really? Who are these people that I don't know that live in Italy that have our name? Who are these people when I was a boy I was so embarrassed by? These Italian soldiers, these wives of Italian soldiers, these grandmothers and great-grandmothers that are now dead but are on tombstones somewhere in the rocky hills of southern Italy. All these questions. Well, I started in a way at the beginning with my parents. I got from them specific information, not that it was complete information, not that it was necessarily true information. It was folklore. When we start interviewing our families, particularly if our families are not famous, and most families are not famous, I mean, most families do not have family records, unless you're a Harriman or a Rockefeller or an Italian version of, might be an Agnelli family, the great, you know, Fiat family might have records.
Did you sit down with a tape recorder with your father?
No, I sit down with a pencil and I don't use a tape recorder. Don, I come out of the school with pre-tape recorder. I'm not part of the technology. I do hold to my rather primitive ways of working and getting information, and my tools are a pencil and a pad.
Well, what an interesting and accessible thing to do, to have such an identifiable ethnic background, as opposed to someone like myself, whose WASPy background has been lost for years, and I don't even think can be traced.
But how many years can it be? I mean, Don, you're a man who certainly can't predate the Puritan settlement. So you're talking about early 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's not so many.
No, I've seen my family tree going back to the 1700s. I think they came over as indentured servants.
All right. England. Well, then, now, if you know why they came over from England as indentured servants, you have to know something of the history of that period in their native land. And if you want to know something about that native land, you will go back, as we would, you would, any reporter would, you'd find out about the history.
But you knew where your family's roots specifically sprang from. In fact, you could drive to the village where they were born.
A little village. I mean, this big CBS building we're sitting on now, the big rock, they call it, whatever they call it.
Black Rock
has got more people in it. As I speak to you now, I'm on the 16th floor of this building, and there are probably more people in this building. I have no idea how many people are in this building, this skyscraper in the middle of Manhattan. More than the village. Now, the village is like this building. It's a mountain. It's a part of a mountain. It just rises up out of the rocks of a mountain, and all of southern Italy is mountainous. All of southern Italy is made up of villages. Villages on mountains. Villages on mountains. The Cuomos, the Sinatras, everybody, we're mountain people primarily, 80% of us. And more to the point, in the United States, the Italian Americans are southerners. They are not, I repeat, not from from places like Rome or Venice or Florence or Milan, fashionable places, the places that produce the great leather that we might wear on Fifth Avenue, sold on Fifth Avenue, the great sweater makers, the great suit makers. We're people of the land. We're the poor. We're the peasants of the world of Italy, of the nation of Italy, I mean. And just something around the turn of the century, around 1888, 1894, in that period, great masses of Italians would leave Italy by boat, usually from the ports of Naples or the port of Palermo in Sicily, and start their movement to this country. My grandfather was one of those people. But we're from the poverty of southern Italy, and so we cannot identify with a Renaissance or with Michelangelo, you know, anyway, either Florentine or Roman or the lovely world of Venice. We are really the orphans of Italy, and out of this immigration to this country, beginning before the 1900s, come whatever constitute Italian Americanism today. I'm just one little dot in that massive creatures that came over here.
Now, Gay, when you went to that village and you spent a considerable amount of time in that area, how did you feel? Was it like being on hallowed ground, so to speak?
Hardly. I went with great misgivings. I actually first went, Don, I don't want to go on too long because we don't have that amount of time, but I was in the Army in the 1950s. I was in college and I was in ROTC, and after I got out of college, I'd served 2 years, and I was sent first to Fort Knox, Kentucky, to a tank command school. And later the unit was sent to Frankfurt, Germany, and I went to Germany for a while. First time in Europe for me. But I had a pass one weekend, and I was able to get a ride on a military plane that went to Rome. And then I got on a train, and I went from the rail station down to Naples, and then further on down the whole length of the boot to the tip of the toe of the boot, and that's where this village is.
So you had actually, before you started the research, had actually seen that village.
I saw. Oh yeah. Now why I don't speak the language. I mentioned earlier that there's this within myself a great aversion to things Italian, a reluctance to identify with Italy, because I grew up at a time when I was very sensitive about being Italian, and I wished I had not been. I mean, my whole boyhood education in a parochial school in southern part of New Jersey, where there were no Italians that I knew, and mostly in that small parish were Irish Catholics. And the town, however, wasn't Catholic, really. It was more of a Protestant town. So I grew up among Anglo-Saxon Protestants during the war years that I mentioned before, feeling hardly any pride in being Italian. On the contrary, I loathed the idea of being Italian. And yet, I'm an olive-skinned person. I can't look like a present. I mean, I'll never look like a Kevin Costner or Robert Redford or... You know, I have a look of the Mediterranean about me, like Mario Cuomo, for example, although he's probably better looking than I am, and only a few months younger. I'm 60. And I went to this village, and as a soldier, wearing my uniform, strange, I would, that uniform was an American uniform, and that, 10 years before, that uniform was the enemy. I mean, I'm talking about, I'm in 55 going to this village in southern Italy. In 1944-45, you know, General Mark Clark's troops wearing the same uniform were shooting up the area. But I go back in 55, get off a train, do not speak the language. Someone at the train station who ran a taxi cab station, there was one cab, there's only one car in the whole village, in fact, that was it, the cab, did understand a little English. He had been a workman in the 1930s, a laborer, and he went back to the village and got stuck there during the war years, but he did understand some English, and I gave him my name. Now, my name, you introduced me as Gay Talese. That's right. I want to be known as Gay Talese on this show and other shows. The lovely Knopf book is Gay Talese. The real name is pronounced Talese. T-A-L-E-S-E is Talese. And Gay is from Gaetano, my grandfather was Gaetano. My mother changed the name in 1932 when I was born because she didn't want to be an Italian either. So they made it Gay. So I'm really Gay Talese. But there's a private self called Gaetano Talese. That Gaetano Talese in that uniform in 1955 to that cab driver that only understood very little English, but he did understand Talese. I said, Talese, Talese, Talese. Oh, and then he pointed up in the mountain and he got me in the back of this car, this rinky-dink Fiat that was passing itself off as a taxi cab, drove up this winding road. On the winding road, we encounter mules, lines of mules, and on top of the mules are people, and they're carrying on their heads rocks and straw and clay pots. The women are walking along the side of the road with clay pots filled with water, I guess. Oh, this 19, I'm back in the 15th century. I mean, this is not 1955 in my head it was 55, but these people are from another time. And this other time, this primitive time, is where I come from. My father was born here. My grandfathers, my mother, are all from this little place. So I'm going up in this cab to this place where it looks like I'm back in the Middle Ages. And they take me to these rows of stone houses, which again were there since the Middle Ages. And I'm ushered into a room where there are a lot of these people, most of them wearing black. Everybody was in mourning because everybody had someone killed, you know, yesterday or the week before, or during the war years that were 10 years before that. And I'm taken into this room, and who do I meet but my father's mother, my grandmother. No one expected me because it was an impromptu trip. And no one spoke English, and I didn't speak, of course, as I said before, any Italian. This cab driver who could barely speak anything at all, and I'm sure he probably was barely literate in Italian because these are not highly educated people to begin with. There's this kind of funny communication, but they got the message fast. I was the son of Joseph the tailor, who was the son of the woman that I'm now facing. Not only now facing her, but behind her were dozens of other people. One of them, a man with a very large head. This man had a misshapen, and he looked like something out of the Hunchback of Notre Dame, played by Charles Laughton. Do you remember mm-hmm. that film? The misshapen figure?
Mm-hmm.
This was a guy, it was a misshapen figure, big head. And this is my father's older brother, who had been gassed in World War I. He at that time was with the Italian army in the Austrian front, and caught, you know, you read Hemingway's Fellow Arms, it describes the Great Battle of Caporetto and all the gassing. This uncle of mine, his head was blown up, expanded. He was a misshapen. This was an uncle. And this is not an attractive picture I'm creating, but I'm trying to give you a visual sense of my encountering the material that would cause me to write this book that you have in front of your desk. And all these other people. And this is the introduction to family life for me. Well, of course, that wasn't a terrific vacation I was on. But I was beginning to explore. Well, I didn't stay long. I wanted out of that place. And I just made all kinds of excuses. And the cab driver, fortunately, didn't take the cab away. So I could, after a preliminary visit, and it was like, they went berserk. It was almost like, I read once when Lindbergh arrived in 1927 and France, the people went berserk at the airport. Here's the man that crossed the Atlantic, the first, you know, genius of the skylands. In a way, I felt like Lindbergh, because I was a hero of sorts. I mean, here was this American soldier who was the son of somebody and who was related to all these people, even though I couldn't communicate. So they were mobbing me, they were kissing me. I didn't want to be kissed. The people's faces were all over me. I was really disconcerted. I was trying to show that I liked being there and I hated being there. And I hated myself. I mean, I didn't want to be there, but why did I go there? I mean, what? I didn't have to go there. It was darn difficult to get down there to begin with. It took me 9 hours on a train going from Naples to this place, to say nothing of the previous voyage to get me that far. But I left. In about 4 hours, I took the next train, went back to Naples, got that plane, went back to Germany, and was glad to be away. But I wasn't entirely glad to be away, because it was a miserably frustrating experience that I didn't deal with, could not deal with, was too young to deal with. I was only at that time around 24 years old. So that was the introduction. Then I went back about 10 years later, then I went back another 5 years later, and little by little I was finding with, then I went back with interpreters.
Yeah, tell and me that a little was, bit, that was, let that me, was, tell that me was about the beginning. That, trying to keep things on track, this is fascinating, of course, but before we run out of time, because I have so many questions to ask you, you did eventually go back to really do research in earnest.
Only when I turned 50. When I saw mm-hmm. your show, I said it was 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Only then did I feel, after I guess achieved something in this business that we call writing, and after I'd gained a little bit of composure about who I was, though I wasn't entirely sure. And I also suggest, if you don't mind, that I wasn't alone. I think we all go through that stage in our lives when we think, I better find out, if I don't know already, who I am. It's important to know that before you perish completely. So I did in 81, and I had interpreters, and I went back. Now I went back as a professional. I told you I interviewed my parents to a degree, and I found out who those strange characters were. That guy with a big head, I didn't know who he was. I later found out it was the brother who got gassed in World War I.
Now, when you went back to the village, you made it clear to them that you were researching a book. How did they react to you? Were they excited by this prospect?
I had no idea. Whoever interviews those people, I mean, they don't have books written about them. They don't even know what you're talking about when you say you're doing a book. They have an idea what a book is. It's a Bible. Or maybe there's some books, but this is not Cambridge, the campus of Harvard. Which, I mean, these are village people, but this is, without overstating my case, and without putting people down either, let me say that this part of southern Italy, not the most literate part, as I've already said in a way, is where Americans of Italian background come from. We come from an impoverished part of that troubled land, and we come from a part where education was never stressed. It's a wonder that I ever could write in English to the point of having a book published by such a distinguished firm as Knopf. I mean, this is where I'm coming from. And I suggest to you, who have interviewed so many people who come from the world of American letters, I'm suggesting that there have been very few people with Italian-American names that have been on your show. I say this with no knowledge, but my supposition is that your writers that you choose to interview are of names that might be Anglo-Saxon like your own, or Jewish, or even black people would come on your show.
I've never thought of that.
But think about how many Italo-American names you've had.
I'd have to sit down there.
Well, you'd have to look at your hand. If you came up with five in all the years you've been doing this show, how many years have you been doing this show?
Oh, close to 20.
20. Mm-hmm. If you could go back to your record, see how many Italo-American writers. You might have had Mario Puzo on for The Godfather. I don't know if you did or not. You might have had Don DeLillo, the distinguished novelist. Who doesn't write about Italian life, incidentally? And you might have had Nick Pileggi, who's my cousin. I don't know. He wrote Wise Guy, became the wonderful movie that Scorsese and he put together called Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. Maybe you had him. I'm not sure you did, but if you did, you should have. And you have me. Now, why? I mean, you have all these singers: Sinatra, Perry Como, Tony Bennett, all these politicians, Cuomo and Ferraro. And all these Iacocca businessmen and all these people who made strides. We're not just the mafia. We have a lot of achieving Italians.
Interesting that Italians have not immersed themselves in the world of letters.
Because of what I'm telling you, we don't come from writing courses at the University of Iowa down there. I mean, it's a different world. Different world. And it's a world of mysticism. It's a world from the 15th century. I mean, we're out of the 15th century. We immigrants, we children of the immigration that began at the turn of the century, of which my family is an integral part, are people that moved out of the 15th to 16th century from those villages, got on a boat that took 25 days sometimes, got into factory life, which is what our grandfathers and grandmothers were part of. We might have had fathers that were, like me, who were tradesmen. My father's a tailor. And then they had sons who might, if they're really lucky and had all things working for them, gone to college. Might. I went to college. I didn't go to Harvard and Princeton. I went to the University of Alabama, which was one college that had a kind of open enrollment for people from out of state. My grades were so terrible I couldn't get into a college in my own state, which was New Jersey. I was turned down by Rutgers, turned down by, I probably never even heard of Princeton, nor would I have dared suggest I was worthy of going there. So this is my education. And this is why people like me being Italian-Americans, are not going to wind up on your show being interviewed about books that they wrote.
You must be annoyed by these ethnic slurs. And remember the one involving Clinton and Cuomo? In reading Under the Suns, there are passing references to the mafia. There, I think there's an uncle who wears a bowler which has
one of mine.
Who may have been a very distant relative. Yeah, who may have been in the mafia. May have been in the
he
mafia.
Was.
But the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of all the people mentioned in Under the Suns, nothing to do with the mafia.
But we have these names. You see, John Gotti's making the headlines today. He's been making the headlines all week. If it wasn't him, it would be somebody else. And I grew up, as again, this 1940s, which I keep going back to, but it's an important thing, because it wasn't only the fascists that were the Mussolini and his people, including my relatives who were fighting on his side. But it was also, the Frank Costellos and the Al Capones and the Vito Genovese, and Lucky Luciano was a figure of the 1940s, as you well know. He was in jail, and Governor Dewey released him a little bit earlier because he had been... I'm talking about Lucky Luciano, engaged. I write about it in this book. Been engaged in trying to infiltrate, and did succeed in infiltrating with allied invaders of southern Italy, certain mafia couriers, mafia spies that helped the Allies. You know, there's a whole interesting story about how when the Allied forces under General Eisenhower invaded southern Italy, the mafia helped Eisenhower's people. I wrote about this. But nevertheless, the mafia people from World War II, and I mentioned Lucky Luciano because he dated, and later on Senator McClellan, Senator Kefauver, those hearings of the 50s that you might recall, still later Senator Robert Kennedy when he was in the Justice Department before that, they're investigating organized crime. And the people that they draw in front of the spotlight of the television are people with Italian names who look like me. So these were our role models is not the word I should use. What should I use?
Anti-hero? Anti-heroes.
They're the people that, who are my friends who are not Italian, think of when they think of Italian names. This has been our curse, and it's Mario Cuomo's curse, too.
Well, since we're going to run out of tape soon, I want to touch on some things that are very important in this book, because I think the key to Under the Sun is your relationship with your father, Joseph the Tailor. And there's a very poignant story, maybe you can tell me about that, in which you are throwing a ball, and you throw it to your father, and he tries to catch it. I guess you were, 12 years old?
Well, I was an escapist. I'm at the back of the store, and there's a lot out there, and I'm bouncing the ball against the wall, thinking, as they say, that I'm the Yankee second baseman, who was my hero, a guy named Joe Gordon. He played in the 1940s period of DiMaggio, and Tommy Henrick and the rest of those people. My father, who never played sports in his life, coming from the world I just described some moments ago on your show, there was no time for sports. It was all work, work, work in the fields or on the side of the hill. And he was a tailor working as an 11-year-old tailor. He never went to school beyond the fourth grade. Anyway, back in 1944, I'm out in the, bouncing the ball against the wall, fantasizing. Father comes out of the back of the shop. I'm supposed to be working. I'm supposed to be helping the pressers arrange hangers on a rail. He sees me, and I'm so surprised to see him, and I'm so worried that I'm supposed to be working, and I'm out there playing ball, and I threw the ball at him. Just threw it. I mean, I went to do it. I was nervous, and I was surprised, and out of the sense of shock, I tossed the ball 40 feet in the air in his direction. He saw this thing coming at him through the air, and he's never saw me throw a ball at him before, for sure. And he sort of put his hands up to protect his face, not to catch it, just protect his face. And the ball hit him on the side of the face, hit his shoulder, and caromed off against the wall. And I didn't know what to do. I was just stunned. And he was stunned, but the ball bounced back and it hit him and rolled against his leg, against his shoe, I mean. And he sort of then leaned over to pick it up, and he looked at it as if it was a strange thing that came from Mars, looked at it, and then he tried to toss it back to me. And he never knew how to throw a ball. I couldn't catch it. I couldn't even throw a ball. He threw it like a girl and came off his side, like girls in my generation. Let me not have a feminist jump all over us here. And it flipped off his fingers in an awkward way. He was very embarrassed, and the ball rolled over one of his dry cleaning trucks, and I crawled under the truck to get it. Got it. When I came out from under the truck, he had disappeared. For me, it was an embarrassing moment. For him, it was an embarrassment. But historically, it told all, in a sense. I was of the generation that wanted to play ball. I was an American, and the national pastime was my sport as well as everyone else who wasn't Italian. To this man from this foreign country with his foreign way of doing things and foreign way of not knowing what baseball was about or sports were about, leisure were about, it showed you how many worlds apart we were. And I think it symbolizes, though it's not the only example for sure, of how we had to be related because we were related, and how we were disrelated. And this is a book really about that strange past that all of us had, not just Italians, the Jews, the Irish, everybody in this country. We're all boat people, as I've said often, and we all come from these strange cultures. But to find out about these cultures, we're going to help ourselves. So the message, if there is one, is that we should know more about ourselves, and then as a nation we might be better served as to how we go about serving our future as a nation.
Okay, to go a little out of sequence, there's another poignant anecdote that you have involving your father, and that deals with his destruction of some model airplanes that you had built over the course of a year. Tell me about that.
It's another example of how the past haunts us. I mean, I was a model airplane builder. I did that far better than I did anything else. better than throwing ball. I was throwing a ball around. I was a terrific builder of model airplanes with balsa wood, you know, the glue. Maybe you did that. Our generation.
I did.
We always did that. I don't know if they do it now. And my model airplanes were modeled after the American Air Force, of course, the B-17, the B-29, the P-38, all those Martin bombers and Bell Air Cobra fighter planes and P-41, all those Lockheed. I just love those planes. And I created a perfect replica in miniature size, as we all know what they look like. And I had these things dangling from my bedroom. They were hung on tailor's thread. I had steel spools from the tailor shop where my father worked and string them to the top of the airplane. And you could, so you didn't, they looked like the planes were really in the air there because you couldn't see the string. So thin was the, so the thread I chose. In 1944, in the month of February, the Allied combined forces under General Eisenhower succeeded in invading southern Italy. And the Allied planes started to bomb these villages where my own father's family, as I said before, lived and live to this day, some of them. And the bombings and the infiltration by the Allied troops and the panic caused upon the villagers by such an invasion was reported in the New York Times and all the papers, of course, that we got in our house. On one particular day, I'm coming home from school, and I'm coming home from school on a day when the radio and newspapers were all talking about this big bombing of a particular monastery very close to my father's home village. I get home, and I hear the noise in my bedroom, the noise of my father with his fists and his clutched fingers pulling out of the sky, out of my sky, of my bedroom, all of these beautifully made, carefully crafted airplanes, crushing them under his feet, pulling them off the ceiling, stomping on them, swearing. And all of this I saw as the destruction of my life. It was the only thing I had done well at that age. I was 11 years old. And he's going bonkers. He's like King Kong swatting these things out of the sky. And I am hating him. I'm yelling that I hate you. Stuff. It's their mind. Don't touch it. And he didn't listen. He just kept destroying the last of my Air Force, as the Air Force of the real army was destroying the last of his village, in a sense, in his head, at least. And it was, for me, again, a traumatic experience of being what I was, a fractional American, an American with ties to my own Air Force, to my own family life as an American citizen, an American-born person. And yet my family extended across the sea to that village where American bombs were exploding all over the tombstones of my father's forebears and mine, in a sense, and my mother's, in a sense. So this is a picture of what it was like for me.
But your father said at the end of this rather minor episode of violence, he said something really poignant to you. Do you recall what that was?
We had a sort of reconciliation after a while, yes. I later on ran out of the house, and I then crashed into a window of a bakery shop. I was on roller skates. I was completely out of my mind, I think, at that time. He runs after me, and finally as the ambulance comes, I was covered with blood because I hit the front window of this bakery shop, as I said. And I'm crying and swearing at the same time. I still hated him. And he says, as I'm almost to be rolled into the ambulance, something like, "Those who love you make you cry." And this is not his, it's a motto from the village. It's their idea of love always has pain attached to it. Well, this is not a joyous story we've been discussing on your show today, but this is close to what I remember is true.
After you finished this book, and after all of these years, and with your father and mother approaching 90, do you think you have come to terms with your father?
I think I have, but more importantly, I think I've come to terms with myself. As a journalist, I told you most of my career was spent living for other people and running away from who I was. 50 was a big year in my life, and now I'm 60, and it's been a big decade in my life, because between age 50 and 60, I have very slowly, maybe in a retarded fashion, come to know more about my roots, and as a result, realize I can't run away from these things. They're too strong. They're tied into me. I can't pretend I'm someone else just because I'm interviewing other people. So it's something happened to me, and I'm not saying it's a happy experience. I'm maybe saying it's an important experience.
But over the years, you've also been a celebrity a journalist. I'm reading much of the publicity material that Knopf sent over, and there's so many personal facts about yourself that kind of make me cringe. I'm such a private person myself, and to see all of these things in print that are not necessarily in your books, doesn't that, you know, in a way,
well,
you've stepped away from me.
I mean, I seem like maybe I'm coming out of my Catholic past, there's something called flagellation. And maybe there's a flailing person that's part of me also that beats on himself in a sense to try to get to be more pure, or let's say more truly true to what I am. And books that I've written have all had much of me in them, even though I've used other people. Even though I'm writing about other people, there's a secret self, myself, that has its fingerprints on every paragraph that I write, even if it's about other people. The book on the Times you mentioned was my only job. The book on the my father was the mafia book, but it was really my father's embarrassment that I was writing about. The sex book you mentioned, Thy Neighbor's Wife, was really a book about my Catholic parish and the sense of sin. And when I researched that book, Don, I really wanted to associate with sinners. I wanted to know who are these obscene Americans that we call obscene because the law of obscenity puts them in jail for being obscene. So I wanted to personalize it. I personalize everything I do in a sense, although I didn't use my own name, except I did in Thy Neighbor's Wife near the end. Near the end of that book, if you read that book, there's a scene when I go to a nudist camp, which was in itself a form of obscenity in our history. I mean, you know, nudity is lewdity, as they used to say, and still do, I guess. Still do. And I'm in that nudist camp, which isn't so far from my home in South New Jersey, where I was born and reared. And I go to that nudist camp, and I saw out there in the river, myself and numbers of nudists are being watched by people on boats, people on yachts, people on sailing vessels, many of them with binoculars scanning the shoreline and the beach on which the nudists were sprawled and standing in the water as I was, and they were watching me, and I was looking at these boats with the Ocean City Yacht Club it said on the back of these vessels, and the people with their binoculars, many of them were from Ocean City, New Jersey, and here I was, an Ocean City native who achieved these things that you generously cite. You know, he's a man that worked in the New York Times, and he wrote this book, and he wrote that book, and he won this award, and he won that award. Here he is sitting out there, standing out there in this nudist community, researching this book on eroticism and sensuality and on sin, I guess. And these people are looking at me, and I realize that I was all my life, in a way, a man with binoculars. I was the voyeur looking at other people. Now, it's turned around, and they're looking at me. These people behind these binoculars are looking at me, and they're seeing me. And what are they seeing? What is this person that is me? Who is this person that is being viewed by these other binocular-holding, voyeuristic people? I think it was a turning point in my life, because after that Thy Neighbor's Wife, for which I was given no credit at all in terms of writing or researching, it was a book that was generally damned across the country, but perhaps it was that book that sprung me into this one. Who am I? What is this guy that the other people with their binoculars are bringing into focus? What's in focus?
Well, Gabe, at least to wrap things up, I see Under the Sun's ends approximately 1945. I have a feeling that the story's not over.
Maybe it isn't. I don't think it is. I'll be on the show again.
I hope so.
Thank you.
It's a terrific book, Under the Suns, by Gay Villiers. Thank you very much, Gay.
Indeed, a pleasure.